time to return to the futures.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the second hour. Well, about 2 weeks ago, I met a local futurist, a Renaissance man in many ways, who are applying a lot of the ideas that we talk about on the show in his work in our community. Now, what's also interesting about Drew Glover is that he was born and brought up in Santa Cruz. He's a native son, if you will, and has been exposed to a lot of interesting approaches to education that I think are worthy of our discussion in this hour, among other things.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about many things that make Santa Cruz the very special place it is, with a focus on Drew and some of the things that he has been putting his time and attention into.
Yeah, so welcome to the show, Drew.
Thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be with y'all.
Yeah, so it's true, you were born and brought up here in this town?
Yeah, I was born in 1985 here in Santa Cruz over at the Dominican Hospital back when it was over on Frederick Street still. So long time ago. Whenever I tell people that, they realize, oh, he was definitely born here. And then spent my childhood growing up in the Live Oak area. So this place, especially this area, is really close to home. Started off on 32nd Avenue, right over there by 7-Eleven at the corner of Portola.
Isn't that an unincorporated area, Santa Cruz?
Is that... Live Oak is unincorporated, yeah.
Does that mean totally. It has more freedom in some ways?
It means it's controlled by the county and no city government. So there's no, like, you know, governing body outside of the Board of Supervisors. So I believe John Leopold's the representative for the Live Oak area. Yeah. Was a really interesting experience growing up with a single mom who was not only working but also going to school at the same time. So she had me when she was 36 and graduated from college when she was 44.
Wow.
And I experienced not only what it was like to be a small child with a mom who was going to school, because she would take me to her classes at Cabrillo for the instructors that would let her go to class.
So you got an early education at Cabrillo?
Yeah, and I got a chance to experience their childhood development program over there. I don't know, I'll always remember it was this room that looked totally normal, but if you went behind the wall, there was one-way glass that the parents and instructors could, like, observe the kids as they were working. And I didn't find out until, like, later, but then I went back there and it was really interesting. And it's a fantastic way to observe children in their natural habitats, the interactions between each other.
So you were one of those kids that were studied?
I was one of those kids, yeah, to see the different kind of relationships and ways that people operate, especially being a mixed race person. My mom was white, so growing up in a white community as a young person of color really...
It must have been interesting.
It was interesting, but I didn't truly appreciate it until I was in college and I took my first sociology class of race, gender, and class in the United States. And that really kind of opened my eyes to some of the reasons why, or put context to the experiences that I was having.
As a mixed race kid or hybrid, I guess, what age when you become aware of that at all? I mean, is that...
That's a good question. Probably, I would say middle school, I would say, is when I finally...
The other kids kind of notice?
Just like you're developing into this sense of understanding the differences between y'all. Because that's what I love about kids, is that they don't see those kinds of differences. They're just there and they see another kid and they want to play with them and engage with them. It's only through socialization and the way that kids are taught through media and interactions with their parents and all these other kinds of influences that shape their awareness and their sense of being. So my mom, when she was going to school, was going and graduated from UCSC eventually with a degree in feminist studies, but she always made sure that there was an undertone of multicultural education so that she was not only aware of the realities of the life that I would be experiencing, but also so that she could prepare me in the best of her ability to be aware of and conscious of what's going on. And even with that intention that she had, it really took an official coursework of looking at the history of the United States, the relationships that different socioeconomic classes have, and then kind of projecting that data that is so thoroughly thought out and researched onto my life and my own experiences. And that kind of opened up a lot of doors.
Sure, yeah. Now, was your dad totally out of the picture?
He was in and out of my childhood very sporadically. I remember once we went to Disneyland when I was probably like 3, and then He came and we swam in a pool when I was like 8 with at my aunt's house. And then when I was 12, this was the most memorable is when I was 12, I flew out to the East Coast to stay with him for 2 weeks. And it was a culture shock, right? Wow. Because—
Where do you live?
D.C., Washington, D.C.
A black section of town? Or?
He lived with his partner, whose name was Elizabeth, and she was a white woman. And so, I mean, I don't even remember it was a nice space, nice wherever area. It was. But there was that takeaway of like, wow, look at how many more people around here look like me, first of all. But more so was the cultural change between growing up with a liberal white mom in Santa Cruz to a traditional African-American dad in the East Coast, where, you know, I was expected to call my elders Mr. and Mrs., where in Santa Cruz, I would go to my friend's house and call them, hey, Susan, hey, you know, John, how's it going? But when I went there, it was like, you need to call him Mr. Smith. And
So East Coast, West Coast became a whole different thing.
There's a whole thing about how you look at people, too, and, you know.
Right, and, you know, I didn't really understand that then, and it seemed like a power trip for me, so I resisted, of course.
Sure.
And that caused conflict between my dad and I, but not terribly, like, game-ending content or conflict. Yeah. But the issue was that every night, and I feel terrible about this now, I'm reflecting on it, this age, I've been thinking about it for multiple years now, is that I would spend every night on the phone crying to my mom about how much I wanted to be back with her in California and stuff. So that really, I'm sure, hurt him. If I were to put myself in his shoes and like, hey, I'm trying to reconnect with my son and he's just really trying to not be present or feels a disconnect and is unhappy. Unfortunately, he and my mom both passed away in 2016. Same year, yeah. He in May and she in October. And unfortunately, I didn't ever get a chance to reconcile or engage. And that was the main thing that she always said and why she never went after him for child support was that she didn't want to damage the possibility of us ever reconnecting again. And I felt a lot of anger towards that, you know, and we had some rather serious conversations over time of like, well, I'm telling you right now to do it, move forward so that, because it would have made our lives easier, right?
Sure.
Or at least more accessible to be able to do the things we wanted to do with a single working mom. Especially the cost in Santa Cruz, which has only gotten worse since then. So I can't imagine what it's like to be a single mother trying to go to school, work, and raise a single child or a family with the cost of housing here in Santa Cruz. So there's a lot of stuff that kind of feeds into that. But what was wonderful about, you know, my mom was that she was just always so supportive of whatever the decision that I made was. And I know, especially because she was my main role model, that a lot of, if not all of the values that I have developed into my adulthood come from what she instilled in me from a young age and into my, you know, adolescence.
Wow.
How old are you now? 32?
32. 32. Yep. 32. She passed away in 2016, so.
Wow. Okay, well, we're going to go for a break. It's KSCO
AM 1080.
We're talking to Drew Glover, and we'll be back after the break. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking to Drew Glover, born and mostly brought up in Santa Cruz. And we're just talking about his trip to visit his dad in Washington, D.C. as a mixed-race kid, suddenly leaving Santa Cruz and being in D.C. You were just mentioning in the break that that's where you had a few
of my firsts. Yeah, absolutely. It was my first time going to an indoor swimming pool. That was really interesting. But I guess that's not true because I went to the Boys and Girls Club here when I was a kid and they have an indoor swimming pool. But
memorable, nonetheless.
Yeah, noteworthy. It was the biggest one. That's for sure. It was huge. There were like hundreds of people in this indoor arena area. Some of the other firsts were to eat the biggest hamburger I ever had in my entire life with a bet that I couldn't finish it. And if I did, I would get $100 to go and spend at the CD store. So you can bet that I ate that hamburger.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though afterwards I literally passed out in the car for probably 45 minutes before we got to the store. So it was an interesting experience all around and getting to travel from D.C. down to Virginia to visit my grandparents in North Carolina.
So you really had a Southern experience.
Yeah. And it was really interesting too. I remember there was a young boy that lived next to my grandparents' house named Spud.
Yeah. And
for the only person I've ever known named Spud. But we connected and we were buddies while we were there and hang out. So it was a good trip all around and then came back to Santa Cruz. And that was when I was 12. But this is the whole, like you mentioned education before.
Yeah. You went to an alternative school here?
Yeah. Well, I started out at Live Oak elementary school. You know, I went to preschool and kindergarten over by that Soquel Avenue, Soquel High place. But Live Oak School was there until about third grade. I was not the teacher's favorite student, that's for sure. But they said it was a kind of loud voice, or that I was always trying to get people's attention and all this other kind of stuff.
Class clown?
Maybe in a way, but then yeah. My mom would always say that they would criticize that I would make a lot of noise, but then when I get up in front of the class, I'd get really shy.
So I was one of you get their attention then.
One of those kinds of kids. But yeah. That could have come from a lot of different places. And kids, especially with the modern education system that we have, there's not a big outlet for energy, and especially in systems where they want you to sit and pay attention and review facts and all this other
stuff. And
that
was the case here, huh, in Santa Cruz?
That was the case at Live Oak and Valencia, and I think I might have gone to one other school before. I finally got transferred into Monarch Elementary, and I was one of the first classes to go through Monarch. It's still active now.
And that's an experimental school?
Or? It was then, yeah. So it was a futuristic look at what education could be like.
Where, so that's where you started to mutate.
Right, so you know, kind of evolve, right? I transformed from a grade-based model of worrying about A's and B's and C's and D's or whatever into a more of an evaluation-based model where each student, it was a small school, so it was two portables over on Swift Street where the ARC used to be over there, and in each a total of 50 kids, two teachers and two TAs. So there was a lot more one-on-one time with students. There was a lot more opportunity to explore personalities and interests instead of being forced into a cookie-cutter education system. Mm. And that's where I really was able to flourish into creating relationships with other students and people. And even though there were still situations that required, as with most kids, is like, hey, we're going to have a parent-teacher meeting, you know, just to talk about your goals and what's going on.
Hmm. How old were you then?
I was probably 4th through 6th grade, so from like 8 to 12 maybe or something like that.
So you were there when you went to DC, you had already been through some Monarch experiences.
Right, and so that's probably made the culture shock even more so because Monarch being a really alternative place, you know, I called my teacher by their first names.
Right.
Shout out to Martha Kaufelt, by the way, if you're listening, because she is really great. I always see, sometimes I see her and her son around, and it's really nice to be like, hey, and it's wonderful thing about growing up and living in the city you grew up in is like, I see my second grade teacher all the time, Don Norris, shout out to you. With all, you know, it's just really wonderful to be here. But yeah, so education is super important. I support those alternative forms of education.
So do you think those ideas should be brought into our public school system?
I think that aspects of them could definitely be brought in. I know change is scary for a lot of people, so to suggest that it happens all at once could be really...
Well, it sounds to me like you had personalization. You got the teacher gave personal attention to your process. How is that possible in a mass school environment?
I think investing more money into our education infrastructure so that we can hire more teachers so that we can have smaller class sizes.
So just have more people.
Yeah, more focus on education. I think that's one main thing that our country in general is falling behind on. We're dropping in the rates on our ranking in the world of developed countries with regards to education. We, looking at the way that we decide to spend our money as a country, there's definitely an emphasis on destruction as opposed to creation. And so if we accept a paradigm shift within ourselves, we can make the world a much better place for the existing generations and also for the people that are going to be coming after us. You just make it a genuine experience to grow.
So nothing like having that one-on-one connection with the teacher. And you think all kids should have that?
As close as possible to a one-on-one. Class size of 10 kids, class size of 20 kids. Right now we're seeing class sizes of 30 to 40 kids and teachers that are underpaid that don't have the materials they need to be able to do the lessons and are usually having to go and purchase the materials themselves to be able to provide the students with the care that they need or the attention that they need.
Well, also these days we also have our personal computers that are starting to talk to us, allowing us to have more of a personalized education, if you will.
There are pros and cons to that, right?
Now, where do you stand on the AIs and education?
So I was at the airport the other day. I just led a trip. I also work at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. Uh-huh. And I coordinated a trip over the spring break, 27th of March through the 3rd of April, to Selma, Alabama with a group of 12 other people or 11 other people. And it was a really great experience there.
Selma, that's where the 60s civil rights movement.
Specifically, the voting rights movement took hold in Selma and helped to push the president, Lyndon B. Johnson, into signing the Civil Rights Act of 1965, the Voting Rights Act, I should say. Hmm. But while we were at the airport in San Jose, there's a little kiosk area where you can leave your kids while you do stuff or watch them play with little robots that are like nanny robots. So there's a single person, a single human that's there and like four or five nanny robots, and the kids are all like touching and playing and climbing all over the nanny robots. And I have such a torn sensation around that, because while it's great to be able to allow youth to engage and play and become familiar with robotics and technology, to deny them or limit the human interaction that they have has the potential of damaging our social systems much farther than they already are, because it creates a separation.
Yeah, yeah.
But
maybe it's not that different than playing with dolls. I mean, kids are very accepting of all opportunities to play.
Right. I mean, as long as there's...
Maybe both are there. Maybe the end is near might be the answer.
Exactly. It's not a one way or the other kind of thing.
Yeah.
It should be a fusion. As with most things in the future, it should be a fusion of things that we know are effective and useful and can improve our quality of life, but at the same time acknowledging the importance of human-to-human interaction, especially in developing minds.
Yeah, I've always felt, now this is purely speculative in my point, but I feel like if you spend too much of the technology, you lose your ability to communicate better with humans. You become more, more, it seems like somewhere on the autism scale, right?
You go towards Pinocchio instead of towards the human.
Right, and there's other detrimental effects to technology with young kids off the bat. One of the things that people show with the amount of screen time and the brain activity that is associated with the screen time, with the release of dopamine and other kinds of neurochemicals, it becomes an addiction to not be able to get away from the screen if you start too young. And there's the issue with the spinal development, because if you have young children sitting looking down consistently at a tablet, it's been shown that it creates an unnatural arc in their upper back and neck, which can cause issues later on in life. So I think that there's ergonomic chairs that are being designed so that you can sit without having to arch your neck down. I mean, and it's a problem not just with kids. It's a problem with all of us.
Well, we're all sitting in front of screens these days.
And especially if you're using a laptop that's down below you and you're looking down at your laptop, it's really important to be able to lift that screen
up. Well, that was one of the advantages of Google Glass, is that you just had it on your...
Right, it's got to make it more affordable.
Well, and I think one of the other kind of reverse evolution things that's going on, too, is that we sit in chairs too much. So now people are going towards standing desks, or they're going towards walking meetings, or all kinds of things that honor our animal nature and take our body with us instead of leaving it behind.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have computers at Monarch?
So this was back, I'm 32 now, I was 12 then, so let's just say 20 years ago. So this was in the late 90s, and...
They weren't a big part of the community.
They were those big computers.
Yeah.
You know, like the... It's weird to say that. Like, I sound like my
like
mom.
Like a Mac 2.
Like, remember, like, Mom, computers were so big back in my day.
They had a separate monitor.
No, I'm saying,
they
had
a box.
They had a separate monitor, a CPU.
Yeah.
And we played typing games and problem-solving games. So they weren't like any... At the Boys and Girls Club, though, I will always remember the playing Oregon Trail.
Yeah, yeah.
Always remember Oregon Trail. Died of dysentery many times. but the...
Well, that's a more of a mud
more
or
of an
a
adventure music, game.
Adventure game?
Yeah. You're like settlers trying to move west, and you collect meat from hunting and all this other kind of stuff. It was a fun game until I learned more about pioneers and...
For real.
You know, the westward expansion and the genocide that was associated with that. So it's a little bit hard to get behind the game, but I'll always remember playing it. Mm-hmm. And it was really fun. Right. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So was it in college where you started getting into other interpretations of America's history?
Yeah, I mean, to get back to early on education and into college, there's definitely a severe lack of focus on the nitty-gritty history of the United States. And they, you know, there's the tendency to skim over some of the really important parts that...
Like, for example?
Like, for example, the impact of colonialization on the United States and the Native American population.
My Native friends call it the genocide.
The genocide, exactly. The genocide of the Native American people. The issue of slavery. The impact slavery had on the African American population, the amazing amount of wealth that was generated for the United States through that free labor of both textile creation and in construction of our nation's capital.
And how much it made the country to have slave labor.
That it's the foundation that they built on, the blood and backs of indentured people. And then also the issue with Mexico and taking California from Mexico and all of the broken treaties that can go on and on. So it's a very dark history.
Well, it's a lot of human history is pretty brutal.
It is. But it's important for people to be able to understand that from a young age so that when they enter into the realm of adulthood, they can take that knowledge with them and be conscious and have those conversations instead of getting defensive or trying to deny it.
Trying to take just one perspective on it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Let's raise the quality of conversation and tell the rest of the story of our history. Much better conversations.
Okay. Well, we're talking to Drew Glover, a native son of Santa Cruz. Be back after the break. News. This is KCO Santa Cruz, the Dr. Future Show. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We're talking to Drew Glover, native son of Santa Cruz, and the future.
Yeah, I just gotta say, I love the music y'all choose for your intros and outros. Like, before your break for the hour, their 15-minute, 2:45, you played, like, Goa Trance on your outro. I was like, all right, Goa Trance. That's pretty cool.
Yes, we're...
Future here now.
Cool. Well, let's talk a bit some of the stuff that you're getting into now.
Yeah. We talked a little about the future or the past. Now we can look into the future.
Yeah, as we start to head towards the future, the now seems to be the great meeting point.
Yeah. So I do a bunch of things in Santa Cruz to try and achieve the goal of creating a more unified and sustainable community. So, like I mentioned before, I work at the Resource Center for Nonviolence.
So for the uninitiated, what's that all about, the center?
Absolutely. So the center just celebrated its 42nd year.
42nd year in Santa Cruz?
In Santa Cruz, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it started back in the late 70s. And it's focused on developing and offering resources to aspiring nonviolent activists. Also a place for the community to come together and have discussions.
Along the lines of Martin Luther King?
Specifically along the lines of Dr. King and Gandhi.
Gandhi.
We focus on offering Kingian nonviolence trainings. So I'm a certified trainer in Kingian nonviolent conflict reconciliation. And so what that does is it's a two-day course, over 16 hours we spend together, and we focus on looking at the philosophy and methodology of Dr. King, the steps and principles of nonviolence with regards to a nonviolent action campaign, and nonviolence in ways that you can practice it in your own life. And also, we look at the idea of conflict, what is conflict, the ways that we can address and deal with conflict, as well as the different ways that we can engage with each other to become a more whole community and build what Dr. King called the beloved community, which is a society that is structured in a way that we can all reach our maximum potential and our systems support us and lift us up so that we can become valuable assets to the community, and with the idea that we all have an intrinsic value that we can offer to each other.
Hmm. Now, do you embrace other techniques like NVC? Nonviolent communication?
Yeah.
And Rosenberg's approach?
Absolutely. So nonviolence and nonviolent communication are close but different, that's for sure. Nonviolent communication is important in everything when you're talking with people anywhere, you know what I mean? Like, sure. I even in the work that I do with my teams and interpersonal relationships, I always strive to use nonviolent communication, a reflection, being able to acknowledge people and their perspective without having to automatically respond and rebuke them.
I mean, situations that come up in workplaces?
Workplaces, organizing places, education places, interpersonal life, you know, all of these things.
Relationships,
yeah. I mean, friendships, mm-hmm. partnerships, all that kind of stuff. It's really valuable. And then really understanding nonviolence for what it really is. When people hear nonviolence, they a lot of times think of a really passive, non-action-based approach, like the turn the other cheek model. Mm-hmm. When in reality, the
Kumbaya.
Right. And so in the training, we talk about the difference between nonviolence with a hyphen in between non and violence, and nonviolence is a single word. Mm. Because when people see non-hyphen violence, that hyphen denotes the absence of violence, and that's all that it is. But in reality, nonviolence, when you are approaching it from a Kingian perspective, is the active and intentional route on how you can achieve positive social change and advocate for the people that are the most oppressed while addressing systems of power that tend to have the ability to exert violence against the population.
So yeah, like police interactions?
Like police interactions, which are traditionally what we see in the interactions and altercations between nonviolent protesters and the state.
What we see on the news.
So we see on the news, what we see throughout the civil rights movement. But if we can rewind and think about the civil rights movement, nonviolent action takes the form of going and sitting at lunch counters that are segregated
right.
and allowing people to spit on you and ash their cigarette butts on you and pour water all over your head.
And not hit them.
And threaten you with, and not hit them and just stay there because you're there with a moral objective to show that not only do you deserve to be there, but you're trying to, the ultimate goal is to appeal to the humanity of your oppressor, right? And that's what a lot of people have a hard time grasping is this idea of unconditional love, or what Dr. King called...
Because they're human too.
Right. Dr. King called agape, which is this idea that someone that is exerting oppression or violence or aggression against someone else is doing so because they're coming from a place of pain. It might be from their childhood and the way that they were brought up, like we mentioned earlier. It might be from situations that they're dealing with in their own life. It might be from economic inequality, because that's a lot of what we see within our country for past, present, and hopefully not future, is this division between class and then the scapegoating into different demographics that cause that frustration, where when you see people and you're being told that they're taking your jobs, or when you see people and you say they're just leeching off of welfare, but the data and statistical analysis proves the complete opposite. It's easy, especially if you don't pay attention to that data, to fall into a mindset of hatred and aggression. And so we want to look at those people that are exhibiting those behaviors. And one of the principles of nonviolence is it's attack forces of evil, not people doing evil. Mm-hmm. So what we're going for is the philosophical and moral approach to show people that we're just, and when I say we, I mean people of color, I mean the oppressed class, are just trying to not only exist, but be able to flourish so that we can be as productive as possible.
Yeah, it reminds me of Fantuzzi's immortal song, "If It's Not Love, It's a Call for Love." In that.
Are you familiar with the music of Fantuzzi at all?
No. Well, I got a phone call.
It's very beautiful.
Folks, if you'd like to talk to Drew, give us a call at 831-479-1080. We'll be taking calls in the next little bit.
I just wanted to give you a little bumper sticker from your last teaching around nonviolence, which I really appreciate. I like to say, forgive now and avoid the rush.
Right, exactly. Approach all things with compassion, right? Because usually compassion is a great solution to a problem. If someone comes at you with aggression, you respond with compassion, it's almost impossible for them to continue with that level of aggression that they approached you with initially. So love is the answer. And as cheesy and froofy as that may sound, love is, for real, the solution to all of our problems. As long as we can move forward together in a place of love, we'll be able to make it happen. And so I encourage everyone that may be interested to come and participate in the training. It's May 12th and 13th at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. It's Saturday and Sunday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. We want you to come. So the main thing is that you come, and it's based on gift economics model. So it's made to not be restrictive for your economic abilities.
So whatever you can afford?
Yeah, it comes from that perspective of take what you need, give what you can, because you'd be amazed when people come to the training and we let them know, you know, so we'd love for y'all to be able to pay this, but give what you can. If you can, pay more. If you can't, pay less. And then there are people that'll pay twice as much, and then people that pay half as much. And it evens out almost every time to where we hit our goal to be able to raise the money that we need to be able to make the program sustainable.
Cool. I think it's really good that you put out the energy of asking and really establishing that everybody has something they can offer, and be in that mindset that we're not really looking for people who just need handouts. We're not really looking for, we can certainly acknowledge the reality of need and the reality of people not being able to give, but it's sort of, is a violation for society to develop this attitude of people of being entitled because they see themselves as having nothing to offer. And I really feel the equality among all of us depends on everyone knowing that we see your full value, and we want you to see your full value, and everyone has an ability to be generous with something.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's an attitude.
Drew, can you share with us one of the more poignant stories from your own experiences in nonviolent actions?
Nonviolent actions?
You know, were you confronted potential situation, or you were part of a situation where you could have gotten hurt and you were able to...
Yeah, in Santa Cruz, there aren't that many of those situations.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Santa Cruz.
What's more...
Well, you know, and just to respond to that, thankful for Santa Cruz, it's kind of a mixed bag because there's a lot in Santa Cruz that needs to be addressed, and there's a lot that needs to be most, well, hopefully won't need to come to nonviolent direct action. But there have been situations where, for example, nonviolent direct actions aren't always blocking streets or going up against cops. It's like going to the city council meeting and making it so that you have a large population of people going there to speak on behalf of an oppressed group or against a policy that they think will be restrictive or something like that. Something that I was involved in was coordinating a march that went from, this was in 2012 approximately, after the courts failed to indict Darren Wilson for the murder of Mike Brown. And so what we did was we coordinated a large-scale action from the clock tower to the Resource Center for Nonviolence, where we had about 200 or 300 people, and we marched and did performance-y die-ins and speeches on the streets so that people would be able to hear some of the issues. And then we led the procession to the Resource Center for Nonviolence, where I led a educational talk about white supremacy, violence in the criminal justice system, to illustrate the realities of what Brown and Black people face in our criminal justice systems, dealing with the state, dealing and interacting with police. So there's a lot. And it's interesting too, because this issue of nonviolence and race and everything is not just something that comes from people of color. I'm actually working in one of our local schools with students and walking them through the six steps of a nonviolent action campaign. And when they had the option to choose what issue they wanted to focus on, they decided to address the issue of race at their school and how difficult it was for white-identified students to discuss race without feeling defensive or guilty, and how difficult it was for people of color at the school to express the issues that they were dealing with around race because of their feeling that it might not be received positively. So powerful stuff. And working with the students, they're so intelligent and bright. And this bridges into the future, right? Because this is the next generation of people that are thinking about these issues and actively trying to take stands to make things happen.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Great.
How old are these kids?
High school, yeah. Grade 9 through 12.
Wow.
Yeah, they're wonderful.
Great. All right. Well, we're going to go to our next break here, and then we've got a caller. You guys, we're speaking with Drew Glover, Santa Cruz, native son, futurist, and guest on Dr. Future Show.
Well, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Right. We're talking to Drew Glover, and we have none other than Billy Sunshine on the line.
The one and only.
Hey, the one and only. Billy.
Oh, gosh.
Do you want me to remind you what you said you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, what did you want to talk about?
No. Don't remind me. Yeah, well, okay, peacenicks.
Peacenicks. That's it. The universe is one crowd, as our friend Reno calls us.
But he's an ex-cop.
Say it again.
I always thought to give peace a chance was give hippies a chance, but never mind that. Here's my question for Drew.
Yeah.
Because I'm the skunk at every garden party.
Love it.
You know, as a Jew, I'm not safe in this world. The Jews tried nonviolence, and 6 million of them went away in a couple of years.
Really? They tried Gandhi approach with Hitler? Really?
Yeah. Nonviolence wouldn't work here, would it?
Was that the question?
Yeah, well,
some situations it doesn't work, is what he's saying.
Maybe. Right, yeah. So... Yeah.
Like Hitler.
Right, like with Hitler, yeah. So the philosophy coming from the perspective of Dr. King is that he didn't come with the idea that there's not the need for self-defense. So he always said that with the idea of nonviolence, nonviolence is appropriate when you are trying to achieve a goal, right? So one of the principles of nonviolence is to accept suffering for the sake of the cause, to without retaliation for the sake of the goal. But when it comes down to interpersonal violence, and especially when, like, say someone comes to your door and tries to rob you or tries to assault you on the street, it doesn't make any sense to die needlessly. And that's what he always said with regards to those kinds of interactions. So for self-defense purposes or for things that aren't associated with those kinds of actions, there are definitely places for self-defense. Now, is it possible to use nonviolence when someone is trying to assault you on the street or in a local setting? Absolutely. But there are definitely circumstances where that does not work. And I appreciate you starting by saying that the Jews tried nonviolence, because nonviolence definitely was a theme theme across Europe and the different countries during that period where nonviolent resistance is hiding people. You know what I mean? Like, it's non-cooperation. It's withdrawal from systems. So all of those are forms of nonviolence. And this gets back to what I was talking about before, about the concept of nonviolence in people's minds. They just think it means not hitting back. But there's lots of other ways to address situations. Now, with someone like Hitler, or someone that's willing to slaughter millions of people regardless and has a country's support behind them...
Let's make this tougher. Let's make this a little tougher. How about today's neo-Nazis and today's Klans people? I feel threatened by them. Do I wait for them to start killing me before I react?
No, I also feel threatened by them too. As a black man, you can imagine that it is as I don't know if it's as frightening for me, because I don't want to project myself onto you, but it's definitely also frightening for me. We're at a point in time right now where nonviolence is still an option. We don't have official Gestapo, right? We don't have state-sanctioned. I mean, we kind of do have state-sanctioned concentration camps for certain individuals. And so now is the time, especially in history, that we need to rally around the concept of nonviolence so that people can have their voice be heard and make sure that we have our political system in check to make things happen. You know, a lot of people have lost a lot of hope in voting. They think they become apathetic and don't think it makes a difference. But when it comes to voting, even if the federal system is broken, our local state and city elections are where we're going to make change happen. So it's important that people participate in their local government. It's important that people participate to make their voice be heard. And when the local officials are not listening to you, you take to the streets, you make your voices be heard, and make sure that you're not doing it in some small silo. You're doing it in a large community of different organizations, individuals, and perspectives so that you can draw in the media, because that's what did it for the civil rights movement. If those dogs had been set on people, or the fire hydrants and fire hoses opened and not had the media there, that would not have had nearly the impact it would have.
So we want it in the light of public scrutiny.
Some of us can't stand the ugliness of violence. I'm one of them. And I would love to limit violence to the violence I do with my voice and my mouth. You know, I feel like...
Like on the radio.
I want to hurt people at times, but I just want to hurt them intellectually, not physically.
So you bring up a really good point there. And while I hear what you're saying and words are very powerful, violence takes many different forms. It goes beyond shooting someone with a gun. It goes beyond hitting them in the face. Violence is allowing a child to starve on the street. Violence is arresting people for not being able to pay their rent. Those are different forms of violence. And some would say that yelling at people or trying to hurt them intellectually is just as damaging as trying to hurt them physically, because words have power. But getting your point across and doing it passionately and thoroughly is incredibly appropriate, and I think we should all be doing it in our lives.
Well, to me, the answer, Billy, I've potted you down for a second here just so that we can all respond in this vein. To me, the issue of any kind of violence is the fundamental lack of respect and the fundamental embracing of fear and denigration of the other. And whenever two human beings are having a contest over who's in charge of the other one, that adversarial relationship is one where the two people can't be civil to each other. They can't give each other an even break because the fear is making them want to dominate. And so really, when you're talking about violence, you've already lost the opportunity. You want to not get to that place and keep the opportunity alive.
And violence hurts everybody. It hurts the people that are getting attacked, and it also hurts the people that are doing the attacking.
Yeah.
Another one of the principles of nonviolence is to avoid internal violence of the spirit as well as external violence. And when you're exerting physical violence or emotional violence on someone else, you are internalizing that within yourself, whether you're aware of it or not, and damaging your own soul in doing those kinds of things. And when I say soul, you know, spirit, your energy, your consciousness, whatever word you want to apply to it.
Absolutely.
It's this idea that police officers, for example, the ones that are fighting against peaceful protesters, protecting water and trying to, you know, ensure that we have a future that we can all live in, you know that it's hurting them inside. There's videos of cops at Standing Rock crying while they're at their post because they know that what they're doing is wrong. So there's a lot of stuff.
It's humanity, mm-hmm. guarding our humanity. Well, I've found that the people who are the most adamant in violent situations are the people who feel the most fear. Mm-hmm. And so they overcompensate for their lack of safety by coming on too strong And so it's just the lack of ability to respond evenly. So, all right. Well, thanks, Billy.
Thanks, Billy.
You bet. Thank you.
All right.
Big topic. Well, in the last few minutes, let's look at some of your other projects.
Let's try and squeeze in some of these awesome in the last couple of minutes. I'm also the executive director and founder of a nonprofit organization here in Santa Cruz called Project Pollinate. Mm-hmm. We focus on environmental sustainability and community building, and our mission statement is to build community through pollinator preservation. And so we do that in a variety of ways.
Pollinator preservation, you mean bees?
So when I say pollinators, everyone automatically goes to bees. And granted, our logo is of a bee, so that's understandably confused.
Okay. However, it's a metaphor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, they're not the only ones.
They're definitely not the only ones. We focus on bees, hummingbirds, solitary bees. So a lot of people really focus on honeybees, but there are hundreds of species, over 1,000 species of solitary or native bees that exist either by themselves or underground that people don't know about or don't pay as much attention to. So they need protecting as well. Monarch butterflies, butterflies in general, moths, bats. Did you know that male mosquitoes are pollinators? Because they drink nectar. They don't drink blood. Only the female mosquitoes.
Nectar from
flowers and plants, yeah. Wow. Also, wasps. Wasps are also pollinators. Now, they're not intentional pollinators, but as they land on flowers and other plants to hunt and do other kinds of stuff and they move on to the next one, they are inadvertently pollinating as well. So there's a lot of stuff. And, you know, it was great in the beginning when you opened up at the top of the hour or closed the end of the hour with the robotic bee story.
Yes, on Mars.
Because one of the things that we do three main projects with Project Pollinate. Habitat installation, so we install beehives and offer beekeeping courses for people that want to learn about how to organically keep bees. Hmm. We develop K-12 education in schools so that people can ask us to come and teach in their classrooms or in their gardens, or we can offer the curriculum to their garden instructors to be able to implement in their schools. But with the robotic bees, we focus on pesticide reform. So right now in the city of Santa Cruz, we're working to get a reduction and eventual elimination of the use of glyphosate and neonicotinoid pesticides by city staff and city contractors, which you'd think Santa Cruz, come on, it would be ahead of the times, but we are still using glyphosate and we are still using neonicotinoid pesticides. We were lucky enough in November, I shouldn't say lucky because it took a lot of work, we were diligent enough in November to be able to get the city council to adopt a 6-month block on glyphosate or Roundup, which is its normal term, which is great. And the reason why we're doing this work is because not only are these chemicals dangerous for humans, but they're detrimental to our pollinator species, especially bees in general. Neonicotinoids are proven to kill bees, and glyphosate targets non-target plants and then has the possibility to disorient bees or has been attributed to the cause of colony collapse. So with robotic bees on Mars, they're already developing robotic bees here on Earth. And so we want to transition and shift course. So we're looking into a future that respects the planet, works towards using the systems that are already there and not trying to replace them with robotics that could be detrimental.
Well, these all work. Right. Yeah, there's private tech. So if we want to know more, where do we go?
ProjectPollinate.org to know more about Project Pollinate, RCNV.org to learn more about the Resource Center for Nonviolence, and you can always send me an email, Drew@ProjectPollinate.org.
Drew@ProjectPollinate.org.
Or use the website.
All right, Drew.
Thanks
so much for being on the show. You're a great guest.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You bet.
This is the end of this week's Dr. Future Show here on KSCO Santa Cruz.
Thanks for tuning in, folks. Appreciate your attention. See you next week.
Stay futuristic.